But with this next cycle coming, with the ETFs online, I think we're gonna see Bitcoin price in excess of 150,000. The Warren Buffett, all his metrics, all those books, I mean, in my opinion, I'm sorry guys, but you can throw that out because it doesn't matter anymore. You need to think of the stock market in terms of liquidity, not valuations. Liquidity is the king and valuations are dead. It's just like a huge levered play on liquidity. So if we're expecting liquidity to come back, we're expecting Bitcoin to rip. So again, we say, is, you know, the Fed's cutting, the Fed's tapering, the Fed's tightening. Are they? They're opening a new lending facility and they're drawing down $1.8 from reverse repo. That sounds pretty good for the banks. You know, we're running into, you know, a cycle now where we had all-time highs before the halving, which has never happened before. And we're also coming into a macro environment, which, like I said, where easing is around the corner, right? Trump has, and there's actually a really interesting rabbit hole with Silicon Valley Bank, who, you know, might have been an intelligence gathering operation by a foreign power. And that might be the reason why they let it fail, because the question is the banking system safe? And I would say,
bing bong, I'm back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend in the house, the Peruvian Bull, writer of The Dollar Endgame, and he's also got a Substack called The Dollar Endgame, so you guys should all check that out. But first, to start it off, we're here in Nashville.
Yeah.
We've got Trump, we've got RFK, we've got Vivek. There was rumblings of Kamala this morning right before. She said no more. But with all this, Trump is allegedly planning to back the dollar with Bitcoin or have a strategic reserve of Bitcoin for the U.S. There's been rumblings of it. So, with all that, do you think that this is a possibility, one? And two, do you think this would help get the U.S. out of the debt spiral that we're in?
So, yeah, I knew, dude, this is super interesting because I kind of have a nuanced answer, right? Like, I think Trump is clearly seeing the power of the Bitcoin community and the crypto community writ large. He sees how much of a lobbying force and just a voting block that we've become. There's a lot of people that want this to happen, that want Bitcoin to be backing the dollar. I don't think that Trump will actually back the dollar of Bitcoin, but I think that he will add it to the strategic reserve fund, which means that it'll be used, it could be used as an asset by the Treasury to defend our currency in case of a crisis. Because essentially what the issue is if you're backing the dollar with Bitcoin, then you're essentially saying that dollars are redeemable in Bitcoin, right? And with them printing so many dollars, that means that they'll, if those Bitcoins get called in, like, they would run out of Bitcoin very quickly. So for them to actually back it would be a difficult maneuver to undertake. But for them to do something like to add it to a strategic reserve fund, where if there's an issue with the dollar, like in the funding markets or Forex, and the dollar starts losing value, they could sell that Bitcoin to try to defend the dollar, theoretically, which would still be stupid, but that is a much more likely scenario. And if he does that, that means hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of buying power is coming online, and it's coming for Bitcoin, like, today.
Yeah, I know. I mean, how can you not be bullish with all this going on, right? I mean, there's 30,000 people that are going to be here for the conference, and all these big names are just coming out of the woodwork to want to speak at this thing.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely insane. But, you know, with all that being said, and, you know, Trump's kind of newer stance on Bitcoin and wanting to speak at this conference, do you think, how did you view Trump's, approach on Bitcoin previously? Because he said some things, maybe people have viewed it negative, maybe if some of them viewed it, like, indifferent, but obviously bringing on J.D. Vance and that aspect, obviously it seems like he's doubling down on the Bitcoin and the crypto community. So how do you view it?
I think before, I mean, he was pretty agnostic, right? Like, he didn't really care one way or the other. He didn't really make any signals stating that he was going to support the Bitcoin community or the crypto community at large. He just seemed like, yeah, this is a cool thing. It's a toy. I want to ban. And he would emphasize in his speeches, right? If you listen to any of his talks in 2020, 2021, he talked about banning CBDCs, which is obviously one great step in the right direction. But he never mentioned, you know, adding Bitcoin to the strategic reserve fund, which is Treasury's like basically pool of assets they use to defend the currency or defend our money in the case of crisis. And again, this isn't backed in the way that most people would think. You can't take your dollar to the Treasury and say, oh, I'm owed 0.001 Bitcoin for this dollar. It would mean just they have this asset to defend themselves, to defend the currency as a block. But I think he's realizing again that Bitcoin, not only as a money, but Bitcoin as a voting block and as a power, you know, constituency is growing. And that growth has now forced him and other, you know, political candidates to now make changes. They can't just stick with their previous paradigm of ignoring this.
Yeah.
Right? This is now getting so powerful that Kamala Harris, right, Trump and other candidates, J.D. Vance, have been signaling pro-crypto sentiment and trying to win over the crypto vote, because in an election that might be as close as this next one, that can be the swing factor.
Yeah. So do you think it's going to be close? I mean, like at this point, it seemed like it's been something that, you know, they were talking about after the assassination attempt, of course, like what happened with Reagan. That was like the biggest, you know, landslide victory when they, you know, tried to assassinate Reagan and they were unsuccessful. And so it kind of swung it that way. But do you think, like, kind of obviously Biden dropping out of the race, I mean, not to get like super political, but I think it's all interconnected in a way, right? Because it's going to affect us in the Bitcoin community, and it's going to affect the economy, whether or not, you know, you believe the Fed is politically agnostic. But it seems like Trump's going to be really pushing for like next to zero interest rates. You know, Biden and the Democratic Party, you know, you don't really know what their full like interest rate policy is going to be. They just want to, you know, bring it down. Maybe not to quite to the extent that Trump does, but yeah, do you think it's going to be like a landslide? And then we can get into, you know, the interest rate environment, kind of where we're at too.
Well, so Reagan, after the failed assassination attempt on Reagan, he had a 22% jump in approval rating. And he, you know, did win that election by a landslide and a half, because, you know, he had just survived an assassination attempt. It kind of made him look invincible and like the right man for the job, and looked like he had enemies, obviously, that want to silence him. So I think that it's going to help Trump. But I think Kamala will prove to be a tougher opponent than Joe, and not because she's intrinsically better, right? I just think the problem is with the Democratic voting bloc, they coalesce around a certain person and they want to defend that person. They will vote for them almost no matter who they are. And the biggest, obviously, you know, gaping hole in the Democratic, you know, nomination up until now has been Joe Biden's, you know, senility.
Yeah.
He's too old. He's clearly having dementia issues, clearly having memory issues, recall. He can't, you know, understand where he's bubbled off the stage. He's tried to shake hands with the air. I mean, dude, you can look it up on YouTube. Yeah, there's 50 million gaffes.
Yeah.
And, Kamala luckily won't have that. The problem that Kamala has is that she's just unlikable. But Democrats have pushed unlikable candidates in the past and done pretty well with those. So, you know, I think that the anti-Trump sentiment is still there, and the Democrats still have a very strong hold on a large section of the country. And so I don't think it's going to be, you know, necessarily like razor thin close. And I probably should have said that. But I do think it's going to be, you know, Trump's not going to get 90% of the vote. I don't think it's going to be like that. I think still 30-40% of the country is going to be voting for Kamala, even though Trump has clearly survived this, you know, near-death experience.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all fair to say. All right. Well, now let's jump into the economy, the macro stuff, the fun stuff, while we're here, right? Yeah. So obviously we've had, you know, crazy stuff in 2020, massive money printing, the fastest rate hike in history. And then now we're kind of sitting here like plateauing, and, you know, CPI prints for whatever you take them. Last print was 3%. We've had Powell kind of say higher for longer, then backtrack, you know, whatever bird metaphor you want to use in the time after he's talking. So I'll leave it broad a little bit to see where your head's at. But where do you kind of think we're at currently? And, you know, how did we get here?
Sure. So I guess, I mean, we can go in a lot of directions with this, because it's important to understand a lot of the monetary plumbing stuff that underlies the system, and as to why, you know, why the inflation that's here is entrenched, why it's what's called a secular inflation cycle versus a non-secular, meaning it's like it's entrenched, it's going to continue to come in waves, and it's not a temporary phenomenon. It's not transitory, as Powell, you know, so famously pounded the table in 2020 and 2021, that this was transitory inflation, that everything would go away once he began his, you know, infamous hiking cycle. You know, the root of the issue lies in really, I'd say, two things. One is the size of the national debt. Now, in previous hiking cycles, you know, like the most extreme example would be Volcker in the 1980s. You know, he was coming at the end of a decade of long of high inflation, lowering debt to GDP rates. And so for him, hiking the Fed funds rate to above 16%, 17%, getting the, you know, average interest rate in the U.S. above, well above 20, that was not an impossible task, because with debt to GDP at the federal level so low, he wasn't at risk of causing any sort of, you know, macro debt doom loop, what we call. Right, an interest rate spiral that starts to add onto the debt, that starts to, you know, increase the national debt exponentially, and then add more interest rate expense, and then just continue this process forever. Right, we weren't at risk of that because debt to GDP was 30%, and you know, fiscal deficits back then were also quite low. We're going into a recession and a macro environment now where you know, the economy is already weak, and we're at 7% deficit to GDP. We have over 130% debt to GDP, $34 trillion. We're gaining about $1 trillion in debt a little over every 100 days. And the deficits alone amount to $17 billion a day in 2024. So 2023 to 2024 fiscal year. So that's an insane rate of debt growth. And the issue that Powell and the other FOMC members face is this dilemma that I've talked about repeatedly on my macro Substack, which is, right, like with inflation coming in and overheating because of rampant money printing, the traditional Keynesian response for a central bank is to raise interest rates as high as possible and keep them there as long as possible until inflation's, you know, back is broken. The problem is when debt to GDP is at this level, you start ratcheting up the interest expense at the same time. And the interest expense must be paid for by somebody. And usually, right, if the banks have enough capacity, they can absorb this debt issuance. They will buy all the extra debt. And the Treasury, right, the interest expense might increase 30%, but it might increase from $50 billion to, you know, $75 billion or whatever it is. With where the numbers are now, right, we would be projecting if the entire federal debt was revalued, right, or rated at 5% interest, we'd be paying $1.6 trillion a year in interest expense. And that's 40% of all tax receipts. And so the problem that they face is like this, you know, chicken. It's like a game of chicken.
Yeah.
They're holding rates as high as possible, and they are having progress on inflation, as you mentioned. CPI last month was 3%. PCE was, core PCE was 2.6%. It's been moderating for the last few months, right? PCE's been below 3% since last October, I believe. And so overall, they have been making progress on the inflation front, but at the cost of causing this debt spiral to start to ratchet out of control. And, you know, October of 2023 there's a famous article in the New York Times that pointed out that interest expense is now for the first time ever above $1 trillion a year. And so again, if Powell wants to continue to play this game, that's fine. But he's going to have to realize that if he's going to crush inflation as hard as he wants, he's going to have to let interest expense blow out, which means the Treasury will now be at risk because they're going to have to find a way to fund that delta, to fund that difference. And with all that interest expense rising, they're either going to have to raise taxes, which into an already weak macro environment, which will obviously cause, you know, a recession. They have to cut spending, which they don't want to do, which will also cause a recession, because GDP by its nature is calculated by including government spending. That's part of the GDP equation. Or they just leave rates high, in which case, like I said, they're just leaving this interest expense monster to grow in silence on the other side of this. And then the problem is now when the Treasury goes out to finance itself, it needs more and more money to fund this interest expense, and they're going to have to either ask the commercial banks for more funds, which is, I can talk about, they've already found several ways of trying to get load the commercial banks up with more treasury debt, or they're going to have to get the Fed to cut, and aka do more QE. And the QE cycle that they do next time will be bigger because they've raised rates and the interest expense is so high, because now this debt issuance is going to be even bigger.
Yeah, so I mean that just basically is like the volatility of everything is going to continue to grow, right? Because the massive amounts of money in the QE that they're dumping into the market and kind of like opening up the floodgates seems like it won't be a good plan in the long run, right? It'll kind of help in the short term. And I think that's part of the issue with like these four-year cycles that we get into. So everybody wants to keep their job, but the four-year cycles like kind of keep going up and down and up and down. And so, yeah, I mean, we talked about Trump a little bit already, but his interest rate environment of going to near zero. Now, do you think that would help the economy in any sense? Like what he would do is, seems like his plan would interest rates near or at zero and add Bitcoin to the strategic reserve. Like, do you think that that would be a way to help combat the debt spiral we're getting into and keep the economy strong? Or like where are we going? Like, it seems like, you know, that the end game is here, right?
I famously write.
Exactly.
So that's the irony. Like, that's the problem with the situation is that, and I wrote this in November of 2022 that we were beyond the monetary event horizon. Because if you include, you know, Luke Grohman famously noted this, if you include Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, and interest expense, and you call, because you call Social Security and Medicaid and Medicare as basically like quasi-interest on a liability because it's a promise to pay the government's made, we were already in November 2022 above 111% of tax receipts, meaning that the government was earning a dollar and then spending $1.10 in just those few programs plus interest. And if you continue that spiral forever, right, the government would be stuck in this loop where it doesn't matter how much they tax, they can never pay the interest alone on the liabilities that they have, both, you know, outstated liabilities like traditional debt and unstated liabilities like, you know, Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security. And so keeping rates high, like we already said, will exacerbate that interest rate spiral. The cruel reality is that lowering rates will only, with deficits this high, will only cause inflation. And we already saw that in 2022, right? Mm-hmm. 2021, 2020, they had rates low, 0%. They were doing massive QE, $120 billion a month and $90 billion a month in treasuries. And what happened is they just had this, we had this massive wave of inflation, the largest in 40 years. And now again, with deficits today sitting at 7% deficits to GDP, the government is spending 7% GDP in deficits alone every single year without a recession, technically, right? Without a recession and without a war or without a major financial crisis to account for. If we lower rates into this environment, inflation will come back like that. And they're going to do everything they can on the CPI front to muddy the waters like they always have. But it's going to come back for sure, and people are going to notice it. And so, you know, it's like you're choosing, you know, the worst, like which world, which, you know, what's the worst of which world you want?
Yeah.
Right. So do you want to have an interest doom loop that eventually leads in inflation, or do you want inflation today?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it seems like with all this, it's like basically we're fucked. I mean, you know, like it's either like, all right, we're going to get a recession in the short term. We don't know necessarily how bad it's going to be, or it could potentially lead to a huge blow up like the Great Depression. Now, is that just, you know, exaggerating it a bit, or is there like a way out of it where, I don't know, like because Trump will obviously not want to be very tax friendly to the American people and businesses. He's come out and said he wants to lower business taxes and everything like that as well. So, you know, like these policies seems like they're good for votes, but not good for like the overall, you know, like longevity of the U.S.
Are you looking for the best way to store your seed phrase? Well, I've got it for you. It's Stampseed. They've got the number one punch place where you can order a full-on package where they've got every single thing. They've got all the letters. You could just get it in there. And they've got this sick hammer, which they've engineered to make it so easy for you to punch in that titanium steel plate and store your seed phrase in the most secure way possible. So go ahead and get your Bitcoin off of these exchanges and use promo code Green Candle for 15% off. They're helping power their show. They've got the Bitcoin logo. You can punch it into your seed phrase as well. If you could see it here, they've got a lot of cool stuff. And now I'm helping empower you to get your Bitcoin off an exchange utilizing Stampseed and storing your seed phrase in the most secure way possible. Now get to it. All right, back to the show.
No, it isn't. And, you know, even Powell Powell, Yellen, like every Fed chair, most Treasury secretaries have admitted publicly that the U.S. is on a, quote, unsustainable debt path.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's insane that, like, Powell even came out in that 60 Minutes interview and was saying all that. He's like, basically, we're screwing the younger generations. Yeah. And so, like, with all that, like, how can that, like, a Fed chair coming out and saying that is just absolutely insane. Like, he's saying the quiet things out loud. You know, when at first they were like, you know, it's transitory, it's all that, like, don't worry, everything's fine. And then now he's like, ring the alarm bells, like, we're screwed. But it seems like he's going to do whatever he can to keep his job as well, where it's like, if Trump is going to be pushing him to, you know, hey, like, you know, lower interest rates, he'll do it. Because, like, I mean, he tried to raise interest rates in 2019, and Trump's like, dude, what the hell are you doing? And he lowered them back down. So, and that kind of showed the initial cracks that, you know, even though we had, like, a decade long of almost, like, incredible growth in the U.S., that, you know, it was a lot of just fluff because, you know, we had things like FTX, like Celsius, all these companies come out of nowhere and then all of a sudden get billion-dollar valuations, and there was this huge boom. What I worry about is that that's going to happen again, but this time it's like an AI boom or something like that, where we're going to have just a bunch of fluff AI companies pop out of nowhere. And, you know, we'll have maybe, you know, the ruse of everything being fine, the consumer being strong, and then everything, like, we're getting back to a worse place than we're at right now.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, this cycle of boom and bust is essentially all they know, because in a credit-based system, right, if you actually let the debt default, you're also destroying money, because debt is money and money is debt. And so if you allow a widespread deflationary collapse, you're allowing a widespread destruction of money. And for the people who are the wealthiest and have the most to lose, that means the most pain.
Yeah.
And they don't want to let that happen. And Powell and the other Fed chairs and, you know, most of Keynesian economic theory is centered around, right, creating wealth effects, creating trickle-down economics. They believe that if you stimulate the stock market, that will, you know, affect the real economy. And that's their conduit of excuses of why they need to pump stock market valuations to record highs. I mean, this year alone, right, we've seen NVIDIA climb day after day, week after week, just grind higher. It's responsible alone for 70% of the NASDAQ gains, one stock. It's not sustainable, but the thing is, what else can they do? Right. If you don't have the AI bubble, there's no other bubble. Like, that's there's no other justification for these valuations.
Yeah.
So what's happening is people are just rationalizing what they see happen in the market. The valuations of some of these companies are 40, 50 times forward earnings. And they're just like, oh, well, this is because of AI. And they just put that, just like with the tech bubble or any other bubble, they just put that Band-Aid on every single wound. They say, oh, you know, this company being at 50 times earnings, that's AI will make this all profitable, make us all billionaires, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's crazy because, like, you know, a one big FUD argument about Bitcoin is that it's too volatile, right? Yeah. But with all this money changing hands and, you know, the QE essentially opening up the floodgates, the S&P is extremely volatile now. Like, I mean, I had a buddy who I just kind of helped get into investing or whatever, you know, a couple years ago. And he's like, dude, like, S&P will only get me a 20% return. I'm like, dude, what are you talking about? Like, historically, that's an insane amount of return, right? So, I mean, I think everybody's just kind of going for this boom and bust, even in the stock market and how people are looking at things and evaluating things. So do you think that, like, the volatility of that is just going to get worse as things are going on? Like, there's going to be booms and busts because, like you said, NVIDIA is, like, basically the darling of the stock market this year, right? I mean, you can't really explain with all the earnings, like, everything that is going on, like, any traditional stock evaluation factor or, you know, metric, whatever, doesn't really make sense when looking at NVIDIA. And if you talk to people who have made their whole careers on, you know, picking stocks, they're like, yeah, I mean, they're either extremely bullish and they can't explain why, or they're bearish and they're like, it's gonna crash eventually.
Yeah, exactly. And I would say they're both right. Both those views are correct.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like a weird thing to say, but in my opinion, the stock market died in September 2008. And it's never been the same. We've had a complete change. And most people, like, what's shocking to me is that most people in the financial industry still do not see and understand the changes that have taken place. Pre-2008, pre-September 16th, 2008.
Why September 16th?
It was right before Lehman collapsed. Okay. And then all the, so TARP, you know, TAMF, Fed's QE programs, like all the programs that were developed post, you know, Lehman collapse to save the system, came into effect and fundamentally changed how the market works. And again, that's not really appreciated. And to give them credit, right, the Fed chair at the time and other, you know, Fed governors, they were, and the Treasury Secretary and all them, they were under severe stress, right? 2008 was a watershed moment for the financial system. You know, New York Fed President Tim Geithner famously said that we were a few days away from the ATMs not working in the 3 or 4 days post Lehman collapse, because the inner bank debt market started to freeze up and the banks didn't have enough cash to lend. And a lot of companies, like, for example, McDonald's, GM, and Ford all used the short-term debt markets. They rolled through the short-term debt markets to fund their payroll. Yeah. So they'd borrow every week to fund payroll, you know, 10 million, 100 million, 200 million, whatever the size is, and then they'd pay it back in the next 2 weeks or the next month. And with those markets freezing up, they had no one to make those markets, and then they were basically saying that they were going to be forced to lay people off, and then the banks themselves were going to run out of cash. They were going to not have any cash in the ATMs. And so that moment's terrifying for them, because that means basically the collapse of the system, which, again, it's inevitable because of fractional reserve banking, but they want to avoid that as long as possible.
Yeah.
So they've spun up all these programs, TARP, TAMF, right, the Fed's QE programs, the foreign repo lending, you know, all these emergency credit facilities, and they injected trillions and trillions of dollars into the financial system. And post-2008, QE and bank reserves came to play a much larger part in how the financial system works and how assets are valued. And so what happened is, if you look at this, and I have this chart on my Substack, if you look at the correlation between the Fed's balance sheet and the S&P 500, post-2008, it went almost to one. Pre-2008, there's very low correlation. It was like, you know, the Fed balance sheet might rise by a few billion that week, and then the stock market would fall. It wouldn't really be correlated, because the amount of reserves being increased was small. But post-2008, you see a complete dependence, what I call like almost like a heroin junkie that's addicted to the Fed's liquidity. The market just snaps into where the Fed's balance sheet is. And once the Fed starts easing, the market starts rallying. The Fed stops easing, the market kind of trades choppy, and then the Fed starts cutting and cutting the balance sheet, tapering, and then the market's tanking. And then they had to respond with every single time that they tried to taper, the market would throw a tantrum, stocks would start to collapse, and then they'd have to turn around and say, oh, stop, sorry guys, we're changing this, we're actually gonna go back and start QE again. So that's what they did in 2019, late 2018, 2019, that exact scenario played out. And so the dilemma now that the Fed has faced is that they've created this monster, that this, you know, market mechanism that's completely dependent on their own liquidity injections. And so if they stop, the market, the music stops.
Yeah.
So they can't stop now. And so the old paradigm of here are the fundamental metrics to valuing a company. Here's PE, here's price to book, here's net cash flow, here's earnings, right? All those metrics that we would use historically now do not matter, because now these stocks are correlated just with how much liquidity is in the system. And with the Fed injecting more liquidity, the stocks will rise, because again, these banks need somewhere to put it. And financial money is not the same as real world money. So if you give a bank $100 million, they can't go out legally and buy $100 million worth of Big Macs or, you know, Beanie Babies or whatever. They have to go out and buy financial assets. So anything that the Fed injects gets injected into the financial economy and spreads throughout stocks, bonds, real estate. Anything that's financialized will get a liquidity injection, including crypto, by the way.
Yeah.
And so what that means is that these valuation metrics that were typically thought of, the, you know, what you call Jeremy Grant or Benjamin Graham, like,
yeah, the value,
the deep value investing guys, the Warren Buffett, all his metrics, all those books, you can, I mean, in my opinion, I'm sorry guys, but you can throw that out. because it doesn't matter anymore.
I mean, I wouldn't even apologize for that. It seems like value investing has been getting crushed for the past 15 years plus. I mean, like, you know, but you know, you said something there that I'm curious about is the narrative. If you ask your mom and dad, you know, the narrative is the stock market doesn't necessarily correlate with the economy. Now, with what you're saying with the Fed, seems like it does now, right?
Are you looking for the easiest way to get your Bitcoin off an exchange? Well, I've got it for you. It's Foundation Devices. They've got the number one hardware wallet in the Passport. They've even got a concierge service that can help you get your Bitcoin off an exchange within 1 hour private onboarding session. And they've got a great app too, which will give you extremely, extremely, extremely private features on that app. So you can use Bitcoin in the most secure way possible. So I've been working hard trying to get sponsors to help you get your Bitcoin off an exchange. And I found it with Foundation. And you can store your seed phrase with a stamp seed punch plate as well. So pair all those together. Use promo code GREENCANDLE at foundation.xyz and you'll get $10 off your entire order. All right, that's enough for me. Back to the show.
I mean, it does and it doesn't, right? Like the Fed, the Fed easing helps the economy in such a distorted way that I don't even think it's really helping.
Yeah,
you are increasing the ability of companies to raise capital, but it's a select few companies, and so the companies that are already listed that are already wealthy.
Yeah.
Companies that aren't listed, like startups, usually have a tougher time. Now again, some of that money does trickle down, but for the everyday average Joe, for the person that's working a blue collar job that owns maybe a couple $1,000 to $10,000, $20,000 in stocks, this isn't doing much to help.
Yeah.
You know, this is mainly helping the wealthy elite who already own, you know, majority of all the assets anyways. The top 10% of income earners own 83% of all listed equities. So when the Fed eases, right, who are we helping? Yeah. We're helping people who already have capital formed. And the role of a capitalist system is not meant to enrich one group at the expense of another. It's just to feed capital to those who are using it most productively, to entrepreneurs, to business owners and job creators, right?
Yeah.
So again, the focus should be on new businesses, startups, entrepreneurship, rather than feeding, shoveling piles of money into Meta and Amazon and Netflix and, you know, Nvidia.
But that's who funds the campaigns, man.
Yeah.
I mean, so that's the problem, I think, with like all this system. But I mean, you're right, right? I mean, like 50% plus of the jobs in the U.S. are from like
small businesses.
So I mean, it's a huge, and it's the lifeblood of the American economy, in my opinion, because, dude, it's just so much. We can't have like these big businesses get so powerful. But when we have these boom and bust cycles, you know, it seems like the rich are able to, you know, essentially just buy assets when the prices go down. And then, you know, when things are booming, they're making a lot of money. And the people that are at the bottom, you know, don't necessarily have that capital or that inflow or whatever cash sitting on the side in order to buy a lot of those things. And so they spend it, you know, consumer-based economy. And then the wealth gap just keeps expanding. And the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. So, I mean, is this going to be a scenario where we're essentially in the U.S., it gets pulled so far? I mean, we're seeing it in a lot of big cities already, like L.A., San Francisco, like some of these huge Democratic cities. So is that like essentially going to be the ending of like the U.S. superpower where it's like, you know, we have some of the richest people in the world, but we've also got some of the poorest people in the world here all living under the same country until something breaks?
Yeah, essentially. I mean, again, this process is not sustainable, right? We saw this in, you know, like Napoleonic France, essentially, before Napoleon came to power. It was the French Revolution. And with, right now, we actually have higher levels of inequality, depending on how you measure it, but higher or equal levels of inequality that the French had prior to their revolution. And so once you get to a breaking point, people start to become desperate and anger starts to get directed at the wealthy. And again, I'm not saying, you know, violence is justified, but when those people get angry enough, then they feel that that's the case. And then they start, you know, organizing and getting in the streets. And there was a study done in in the Middle East during the Arab Spring that found that the countries that had major revolts were the countries where food inflation had grown the price of food to more than 30% of the disposable median income. So once you hit that critical level, 30%, that's the part where people are spending a third of their money on food. And obviously they have other expenses as well, rent, you know, transportation, education, all that stuff. And so if they can't buy food, that's when the riots start. Like, unequivocally, every country that reached that level, riots were happening. And so the question is, you know, will the U.S. reach that level? And if they continue on this path, I mean, I think it's inevitable. It's just a matter of time, right? Are we talking 10 years, or talking 12 years, or talking 8 years? You know, it's probably somewhere in that time frame. Or is it, you know, even sooner if they make even more blunders? Could be, right? But this is not a process that will, you know, despite the reservations of a lot of, I would say, dollar bulls, I think that this is not a process that takes 20 or 30 years. I think we're already in the middle of it, and it's just going to get worse because this is an exponential process, as we're seeing with the debt.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah, we're just going to, I think, unfortunately, we're just going to see increasing inequality until the system has changed.
Yes, it's like the gradually then subtly that Parker Lewis talks about, right? Yeah. So, but you know, we've danced around crypto and like kind of like the risk on, risk off assets. Obviously, we got a talk coming up here. This is pre the talk. It's probably going to come out a little after that. But you know, generally speaking, risk on assets do really well in like low interest rate environments because they get a bunch of money pumped in. But what's interesting about this, you know, recently is that obviously we've been talking about Nvidia. So, you know, Nvidia has obviously been the darling of the stock market. It's been viewed as like a risk on, like kind of, you know, tech kind of asset. So how are you viewing just like, I guess, in general risk on assets currently because of the environment? Obviously, there's, you know, six or seven total stocks that are just kind of carrying the market at this point. So yeah, like is it more of a risk on environment, or is this kind of an anomaly because there's just seven carrying the entire stock market? Like, how are you looking at the?
Are you looking for the best way to orange pill your friends and family? Well, I've got a way for you that's got a little bit of a nostalgia factor. I've got Bitcoin trading cards. They've got the Genesis pack. I've got an open pack right here sitting here where you can hand out a bunch of these cards with some great, great artwork. We've got tyranny, we've got fear, uncertainty, and doubt right here, the FUD card. So we've got a lot of great things to teach you a bunch of lessons about Bitcoin in the current space. And they've even got some cool things of cool people even doing some stuff in the Bitcoin space. I've got the Bitcoin racing card here, even signed by my boy, Chris Primetime McKenzie. So you can get all of that at btc-tc.com. Use promo code GreenCandle. You can get 10% off your entire order to orange pill your friends and family and collect some cool artwork of people that are doing some awesome stuff in the Bitcoin space and help spread that orange pill around the globe. All right, enough from me. Back to the show.
At the entire environment. Yeah, I would say, so I think we're in a quasi risk on environment. And what I mean by that is, again, what you were saying is it's kind of isolated to a few stocks. It's the tech bubble and the AI bubble that are leading this charge for the NASDAQ and the SPX higher. It's not a broad-based rally in every single stock. If you look at the value of most stocks, they've only done moderately well this year, some of them even down. But the tech darlings have been the ones leading the charge. And this will continue, even with high interest rates, as long as something called, you know, global net liquidity is increasing. Because what we've come to understand is, you know, in the last 5-8 years with the interconnectedness of the global financial system, easing happening in any country affects the US because of the massive capital flows that are attracted into the US because of our robust, you know, stock and bond markets. And so if you look at, like, for example, I charted this during the Japanese yen interventions of May of this year. Every time that, you know, you'd see Bitcoin retracing and then you'd see the Japanese yen face a major intervention, $50 billion, $30 billion thrown into the yen. And right when that money would come in, you'd see Bitcoin rebound. And then a few days later, in after the FOMC in May, that the same thing happened again, where Bitcoin was finding a local bottom. It was at like 59K or something like that. And they intervened in the yen, and within a few hours, Bitcoin rallied again. And so what we saw there was like, every time there's easing, this asset rallies. Yeah. And it doesn't matter where the easing is, right? The Fed is not technically easing on their balance sheet. Although they are easing, and we can go into this, they're easing in other ways. They've found new ways to basically add liquidity to the system without putting it on their balance sheet. You have reverse repo, you have the TGA, you have the SLR exemption, you have, you know, there's change in reserve requirements. Like, there's tons of different ways for them, tons of different levers for them to pull now that they've created.
Yeah.
You know, they could even restart the BTFP, right? They could do, they could create new programs, new lending programs. There's just tons of ways for them to add liquidity to the system without actually having it show up on their balance sheet and making it look like they're actually easing. But if other countries ease, even while we're steady state, then the global liquidity indicators rise, which means, again, with global liquidity rising and a lot of that liquidity being sucked into the U.S., we see a rise in U.S. assets. And so as long as the global system is easing on net, we're going to continue to see stock prices rise here, because that's just the way the system works. Like I said, you need to think of the stock market in terms of liquidity, not in valuations. Yeah. Liquidity is king and valuations are dead.
Hey man, I like that. I like that a lot. But so yeah, you said there's like the different ways of easing, right? I mean, you went into a few of them. Now, from like the consumer perspective, do you think, you know, how much do you take into account like things like pausing student loan payments and some of the tactics that they did to try to help out the consumer? Do you think that that is like another way of QE that maybe they'll get into? Maybe it's, I don't know, I don't even know, like some of the major debt areas outside of like just mortgages at this point. But maybe it's, they say no interest on credit card debt for, you know, a certain amount of period of time. Like maybe they try to pull something like that to try to help the consumer. Now, how drastic do you think that they could get with that? And do you think that it's something that in the end helps? Or is it just, you know, kind of, I guess, in a sense, just injecting something really quick, kind of like the stimmy checks we got a few years ago?
Well, it's like, look what happened with the stimmy checks, right? What ultimately happened with that? We had inflation.
Yeah.
So we all paid for it.
Yeah, exactly. A lot more than the whatever, $1,200 or whatever.
$1,200, because ironically, you know, that spending bill was north of $1.1 trillion, if I remember correctly. Yeah. And they paid out only, you know, a couple hundred billion to American citizens.
Yeah.
And so it was not the cornucopia that they claimed it was. And the inflation that we got, post-COVID, more than made up for that $1,400, right? Most people spent all that $1,400 and more in the inflation wave that came. And so anything we do, we will pay for. Yeah. Somehow. There's Milton Friedman said there's no such thing as a free lunch, and he was absolutely correct. So if we, like, let's take the student loan issue, for example, right? Student loans are at a record high, well north of $1 trillion in the U.S. The median amount per borrower is now north of $30,000. And, you know, or the average amount per borrower is now north of $30,000. And student loan debt obviously is a huge political issue, because if you can absolve that student loan debt, you get rid of a lot of deflationary pressure on a lot of young people. Now, doing that would necessitate QE or some form of it, right? The government doesn't have the money to forgive all the student loans. They have less than $700 billion in their TGA, so they would have to borrow. Who's going to fund that borrowing? Now, it's either going to be the banks, which means the banks have to create money to lend to the Fed or use their own capital, which puts them more at risk, or it's the Fed. And if the Fed's going to ease, that's just going to, with deficits this high like we already covered, it's going to create an inflationary problem down the road. So we may be able to get out of the student loan issue in the short term, right? That might boost economic growth. It might improve overall credit conditions for the economy, but we would pay for it in a few years with the inflation that comes down the line. Yeah. And so it would help the few at the expense of the many.
Yeah.
It's just another way of socializing.
Yeah. And I mean, it seems like, I mean, you know, you get into the student loan just issue at a whole, right? I mean, you're just giving all these 18-year-old kids thousands, tens of thousands of dollars to go get degrees that, you know, they're not going to end up using. So, I mean, I think there's like a deeper rooted issue in all this too. But
it's insane if you think about it, right?
Yeah.
You're telling a kid, like, when I was 18 and I wanted to start a business, if I would go to a bank and say, hey, can I please, I have this business idea. Maybe I already have like an early mock-up of it. It's already making a little bit of money, an MVP. Can I scale this? Can I get a loan? I'm making $4,000 every 3 months. Can I get a loan for $10,000 to scale? No, no way. No way, Jose. You don't have cash in the bank. You need a guarantor. You need to have a credit rating. You need to have verified audited financial statements. Yeah. You need to have all this shit. But if you're going to college to get a liberal arts degree, they just like slap you with $30,000 and say, here you go, kid. Yeah. Like, go for it.
Exactly.
It's the most backwards fucking system ever. And the fact that there's a federal guarantee on student loans and non-bankruptcy removal clause, which means like you can't expunge the debt through bankruptcy, I think is fucking evil.
Yeah.
You know, you're loading these kids, you're telling these kids they can major in whatever they want, even if it's an unprofitable career, even if it won't ever make them money. You're loading them up with debt in a form of slavery, right? As Thomas Jefferson so famously opined.
Yeah.
And you're throwing those kids out to the wolves, and then you're making sure that there's no way they can get rid of it. So the only way out is through. And those kids, you know, again, there's no credit lending standards. Everyone gets a loan versus things like actual businesses or startups that need money. You can't, you know, you're pulling teeth to get a bank to give you a loan for that.
Yeah, it's insane.
But like, all right, so, you know, you mentioned the banking system too. I want to get into the health of that. Obviously, we saw Silicon Valley Bank. We've seen some, you know, rumblings that the banking industry was going to fail, and then nothing kind of came of it outside of after the Silicon Valley Bank failure and everything like that.
I wouldn't say nothing came out of it. A lot of stuff came out of it.
Okay, then let's dive into that, because it seems like, I mean, obviously it was like one of the biggest bank failures in the U.S. history, right? So I'm not trying to minimize anything like that. I'm just trying to say that it seemed like everybody was ringing the alarm bells very rapidly after that happened, like the banking industry was going to collapse. Now, I want to see how you view it. Do you think that there's a potential of that, or that we could be getting to that point? You know, because, I mean, banks are getting harder to give out money and everything like that. But it seems like every other day I get an email from one of these banks to give me some money for a business loan. And they're trying to, you know, lend out more money, it seems. So how do you view the health of the banking industry?
So it's I would say it's segregated, because there's a categorical difference between the large banks, what are called the prime banks, the G-SIBs, and everyone else. The JP Morgans, the Goldmans, you know, the Wells Fargo and B of A's of the world have access to the Fed discount window. They have access to extremely cheap interbank funding rates. They have huge pools of capital. They have huge amounts of collateral. They are basically equipped to weather any storm. Now, the difference comes for the regional banks, the small commercial banks that do commercial bank lending in, you know, real estate, you know, both commercial and residential, and that do, you know, maybe more speculative investments like what Silicon Valley Bank was doing, which I looked at their balance sheet and their income statement, and they had a substantial amount of private equity investments, including warrants and stock options and all these startups that they were servicing. And Silicon Valley Bank also had a venture arm, which was investing. And there's actually a really interesting rabbit hole with Silicon Valley Bank we probably don't have time to get into, but, you know, it might have been an intelligence gathering operation by a foreign power. And that might be the reason why they let it fail, because it was like potentially a threat to, you know, a potential way for a foreign entity to gain information on like the high tech sector of the US to capture our best ideas and you know, knowledge. But in the wake of the Silicon Valley Bank failure, we had, you know, multiple things go wrong. First, you know, before that we had Signature Bank, we had, I think, Silvergate Bank, and we had several other banks go under. After it, we had Credit Suisse, which is a G-SIB, collapse in April of 2023. And shortly after that was First Republic. And PacWest also went into trouble. And so we had several other banks with issues. The Fed responded. The Fed learned their lesson, you know, largely, let's say, not fully, but from 2008. And they opened up lending facilities. They opened up the discount window to shovel as much money into the banks. And the BTFP, the new lending facility they created, was specifically designed to plug the holes in the banking system, because they made it so it was a borrowing facility that would value all the bonds posted to it at par. Because essentially the problem was all these banks had loaded up on debt, and mostly government debt at 0% interest rates. And when the Fed hiked during 2022, all these bonds, especially the long bonds, because of convexity, were getting fucking hammered. You know, at 5% rates, the long bonds, like if you look at TLT, the long bond ETF is down 50%. Yeah. So if you have a portfolio of mostly long bonds, you're a small regional bank, you have a lot of commercial real estate, which is already running into trouble because of this commercial CMBS bomb that's a slow motion train wreck, and you have long treasuries, long dated treasuries, which are also going under, like, you're kind of fucked. Yeah. And so this BTFP that was opened, now they have all these bonds and all these MBSs. They can value them at par, at like the face value, not at the real market value, at double their actual value, and that will fill the hole in the balance sheet. And that facility was well used, right, for over a year, with its peak reaching like $160 billion, which was helpful for them. But even more than that, like I said, the Fed found different ways to plug the hole in the banking system. And one of the biggest ones was reverse repo. So reverse repo is essentially like a cash hoard that the Fed keeps on the balance sheet. Banks post cash to the Fed, and the Fed gives treasuries and collateral. And it peaked around $2.4 trillion in 2022. And as the Fed began their hiking cycle through 2022 and 2023, it was drained down. And 2023 alone saw like $1.8 trillion come out of reverse repo. So again, we say, is, you know, the Fed's cutting, the Fed's tapering, the Fed's tightening. Are they? They're opening a new lending facility and they're drawing down $1.8 trillion from reverse repo? That sounds pretty good for the banks.
Yeah.
And despite all that, the most recent FDIC report came out and said that the number of banks on their problem list, which means at risk of bankruptcy, or, you know, nearing, you know, solvency risk, increased by 36 banks in the last quarter. And it's still at highs, at a record high, and we still have almost $1 trillion in unrealized losses throughout the banking sector. So again, the question is the banking system safe? And I would say, as long as the Fed is doing their programs and creating liquidity, sure. Once they stop, once the music stops, boom. Things will go wrong very quick. But that's more of the argument that I have of why the Fed is trapped in this black hole. They cannot stop printing money. They cannot stop creating liquidity. And they're doing this game of musical chairs, right? They have reverse repo, then they have BTFP, then they have TGA, then they have, oh, we're easing. But now, like, for example, in the Fed meeting in April, right? They're like, well, we're going to be cutting, but now at a slower pace, right? We're going to be tapering, but at a slower pace. So we're going to reduce the balance sheet much more slowly. So that also helps the banks.
Yeah.
So there's all these different things that the Fed's doing in the background to keep the lights on and keep this wound that's been festering under the surface from showing itself. And, you know, when it does, like, I mean, just last month, you might have not seen this, but it's probably you know, kind of shoved under the rug under most other financial news. Another bank called Republic First Bank Corp collapsed.
Okay, yeah, I didn't even know that.
And yet, Schwab Corporation is now facing, you know, they just had a drop in their net interest margins. They have 200% losses, unrealized losses to equity. Like, there's other banks that are having issues. The thing is, you know, currently as the Fed is operating, they've been able to paper over the problem well enough to hide it and to not make it look as bad as it really is. And especially, like I said, for the rural banks, for the small regionals, the problem is not good. Now, the question is, if the Fed actually allows these banks to fail, what happens? And I think the Fed's not going to allow, obviously, a repeat of the Great Depression, because that is massive price deflation, massive asset value destruction, and that hurts the banks and the wealthy the most.
Yeah.
It hurts all of us, obviously. It's not painless for any of us, but it hurts them the most. And so the Fed doesn't want to do that. And so even if there are bank failures, you know, in my opinion, they're clearly going to do something to save those banks. And probably what that means is consolidate them into the larger banks. So like we saw JP Morgan, hoover up Silicon Valley and gain 18,000 depositors in a week. They'll probably do the same. And we'll just see more consolidation of the banking industry, allowing the banks to get ever larger, the G-SIBs, and all of the smaller banks die and be absorbed into this monster.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like, the banking sector is almost like going to be like Canada, where we have like a few large ones and then there's essentially no regional banks. But we've gone this entire interview and we haven't even talked about Bitcoin yet.
So, yeah, I know.
Yeah, I mean, we gotta dive into that. Sure. So obviously we're here at the conference. There's a lot of rumblings. How are you looking at Bitcoin kind of fitting into all of this? Because it is interesting that it's almost like the first time we'll see Bitcoin at potentially a bull run and potentially a recession or some bad economic environment in it. So how are you looking at it? And where do you think we're going from here?
I mean, I'm extremely bullish, obviously, as most people are at the conference. We're running into a cycle now where we had all-time highs before the halving, mm-hmm. which has never happened before. And we're also coming into a macro environment, which, like I said, where easing is around the corner, right? Trump has signaled to Powell that he doesn't want him to cut before the election because Trump wants to save all the cuts till after he's elected. And he doesn't want that to be used as a weapon against him. And so the easing that's around the corner may be a little, may not come in September. We'll see if Powell acquiesces to that pressure. But any easing and any liquidity injection in any form is massively bullish for crypto, massively bullish. Michael Howell of Capital Wars, he also runs a macro fund. He has done retrograde analysis on different assets and liquidity measures. He's been tracking liquidity very closely, very accurately too, I'd say. And what he has found is that if you look at gold, you look at SPY, and you look at Bitcoin, their response to every unit of liquidity injection is different. So SPY is almost one for one. So the more liquidity that gets injected, if $1 of liquidity is injected, the SPY will rise by $1 value, generally. If $1 of liquidity is injected, gold usually rises by about, between 1.2 to 1.6x. So gold also responds well. But gold also, it's strange because gold usually actually front runs the debasement and then also retraces. So it kind of is less correlated directly, but it is correlated to liquidity. Bitcoin, his crypto index in general, is above 8x for each liquidity unit injected. Meaning if the Fed injects, 50 units, it'll increase by, right?
Eight times that.
Yeah. So 400. So it's just like a huge, it's like a huge levered play on liquidity. So if we're expecting liquidity to come back, we're expecting Bitcoin to rip. And Bitcoin right now is trading, in the 50-60 range, which makes sense because, again, global liquidity for the last few months has been kind of flat. We had a drawdown in April because of tax receipts going out. And we've had a couple of Japanese yen interventions that have offset that. But overall, liquidity has just been slowly grinding higher slightly, but mostly flat. And, Bitcoin itself has been basically trading the same. But with this next cycle coming, with the ETFs online, I think we're going to see Bitcoin price in excess of $150,000.
There we go, man. I love it. Well, thank you so much for coming here and sharing your time with me, man. Why don't you tell everybody where they can find you, find more about your info and your Substack and your book and all that kind of stuff.
Sure, yeah. So I write on Twitter under Peruvian_Bull. I'm on Substack at Peruvian Bull. It's called The Dollar Endgame. I have a free and a paid subscription. You can sign up for either. And then I have my YouTube also under Peruvian Bull. And my Noster is pinned in my bio on Twitter. So you can find me there. I produce a mix of free and paid content. So it depends on how deep you want to go on this stuff. But yeah, I'm really interested in writing macro and just learning more about it and informing people what I find.
Yeah.
Because I think the problem with macro is that it's such a confusing world. It's so, there's so many different, you know, perspectives going on all the time. It's hard to parse through the noise and get the signal. And so what I'm trying to do is get that signal for people and then convey it in a way that's easy to understand.
Yeah, man, you do a great job. So I'll put all that in the show notes too. So, man, thanks so much for coming. Awesome.
Thank you.
All right, appreciate it.
Thank you for tuning in to the latest episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you really enjoyed this one, I've got another one cooking up for you. You can click that right here and you can go to the next episode, which is an absolute banger, where you know I'm bringing you only the latest and greatest guests. Or if you're looking for more macro-related content, you could check out my other channel, Macro Insights Pod. I got it linked for you right here. So where I'm bringing you more about stocks, real estate, traditional finance stuff. So go ahead and check that out. And if you enjoyed this podcast, go ahead and hit that like, hit that subscribe button, and tell a friend to tell a friend. All right, enough from me. I'll see you at the next one.